This is 89.9 WWNO. I'm Janae Pierre, and it's time for All Things New Orleans. On today's show, political analyst Dr. Silas Lee chats a bit about the mayor's race. Then Jessica Rosegard returns with Cityscapes columnist Richard Campanella. We'll also discuss the Truth, Racial Healing, and Transformation Initiative with Flozell Daniels Jr., president and CEO of the Foundation for Louisiana. But first...
Why are you running? Are you doing this for world peace?
Are you doing this for the homeless?
Are you running for women's rights?
Or for the environment?
Next month, a group of runners will take off from Jackson Square and run 140 miles to the state capitol in Baton Rouge. Why would they want to do that? Joining me now to talk about Run for All Women Louisiana is Ambassador Amber Harper. Amber, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Hi, Janae. Thanks so much for having me.
So tell us about the nonprofit organization Run for All Women.
Sure. Run for All Women was started by Allison Desir, who is based in Harlem, New York. She sort of felt like many of us, like myself, after the election in November, that maybe she hadn't done enough. And so she, as a runner, was just looking for ways to resist the status quo and really make her voice heard and do something impactful. And so she had this crazy idea in January to run from Harlem, New York, all the way to Washington, D.C., which was 240 miles. She called one friend up. She was on board. And so she had this idea that she would get three other women. So that's where Run for All Women really came about, mm-hmm. and that was the birthplace of it. Her goal was to raise $44,000 for Planned Parenthood in honor of our 44th president, Barack Obama. And, you know, if you're familiar with the story, the overwhelming support was unbelievable, and their team grew leaps and bounds as they traveled through New Jersey and Pennsylvania, and they ended up raising more than $100,000 for Planned Parenthood. And so as a result, she had tons of women and men reaching out to her, wanting to get involved after the run. You know, what could they do to help to further the movement? And that's when she put a call out for ambassadors across the country. And that's where I stepped in and joined the cause.
Wow. So what issues sparked the fire for the run here in Louisiana?
So for me, I'm a native from Lafayette, Louisiana. And I thought it would be really, really important to bring this run to my home state to really raise awareness around women's issues and women's reproductive rights and to further that conversation within the state of Louisiana.
So how effective is running for social change?
That's a great question. You know, I think that all of us are looking to do something in the means of social change. And so I think running is just one of those venues, right? It's one of those outlets. Everyone has different passion points, different hobbies, different skills. And I think we're living in a time where, you know, everyone's looking at what do they have, what talents do they have, what resources do they have that they can put to use for social change. And I think running is one of those avenues.
Now, you mentioned that the money donated for the run in Harlem went towards Planned Parenthood. Is there a goal for this run here in Louisiana?
Yes. So the money that we raise for Run for All Women in Louisiana will go towards Planned Parenthood Gulf Coast. The Gulf Coast region, that combines Louisiana and Texas, but our funds will only go to the clinics in Louisiana. And our goal right now is $10,000.
How do women get involved with this initiative?
So whether you're a runner, you want to donate time to drive one of our vans, you want to cheer for us, you want to donate items like water or food, you can go to our Facebook page, which is Run for the number 4 All Women LA, to get more information. We are currently still looking for a couple more runners. Right now, we have a team of 10 runners. I've engaged with some amazing New Orleans running clubs, one of them being the 504th, which is really all about bridging the gap of cultures in New Orleans, and also Girl Gang New Orleans, which is a great group of strong women.
Amber Harper is the ambassador of Run for All Women Louisiana. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
Run for All Women is a run for all, welcoming allies of all race, gender, and sexuality. Learn more at runforallwomen.com. The Kellogg Foundation recently announced a $24 million grant awarded to 14 organizations to implement its Truth, Racial Healing, and Transformation project. New Orleans and Baton Rouge are among the chosen cities whose process is being spearheaded by the Foundation for Louisiana. Joining me now is their president and CEO, Flozell Daniels Jr. Flozell, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about the Truth, Racial Healing, and Transformation framework and what this grant means for the state's two major cities.
Sure. You know, it's an exciting time for Baton Rouge and New Orleans. The Kellogg Foundation, in its wisdom, decided to take a retrospective analysis of what was its America's healing work over the last 10 years. And what they developed was a framework based on responses from hundreds of their partners around the country that really allowed them to think about a next generation opportunity to deliver on the promise of, as the name implies, truth, racial healing, and transformation.
Mm-hmm.
The way the framework is developed is the truth part of it is really about telling a narrative that is truthful, creating a space, in our case, in Baton Rouge and in New Orleans, where all residents get a chance to see themselves in the narrative and the story of those respective cities. So what does it look like for Black people and white people and Native indigenous communities and Latinos and Asians and others who really want to see what contributions have they made to the development of these amazing American cities? The racial healing part of it builds on that truth-telling narrative so that we can build relationships. To be honest with you, it's not sort of a kumbaya, let's all get along. It really is about authentic relationship building based on seeing each other's value. And then the last part of the framework, which is critical, is the transformation work, which allows us, by way of this truth-telling narrative and these stronger relationships, to actually work on policy and practice. And so the transformation happens across three critical categories. One is separation, the things that keep us apart. There's an economic category that really looks at the sort of economic inequities. And then there is the last category, legal, which, as the name implies, the legal construct. There are actually things built into the legal construct that really keep us from building relationships and being equitable. And this Kellogg Truth, Racial Healing, and Transformation framework that we're very fortunate to be a part of really is going to operate from that perspective.
You know, you mentioned that transformation is maybe one of the most important parts of this framework. Let's talk about the role policies play in shaping this equitable reality.
You know, since the beginning of the country, what we find by way of analysis is the legal construct, both the Constitution and local laws in local communities, are critically important in either creating opportunity or, quite frankly, undermining opportunity for us to be set on an equitable plane and to be similarly positioned so that we can get the kind of outcomes for our families and children, for our economies, and for community outcomes that in which we have an interest. So it won't surprise you that there's a lot of interest, and maybe the best example was the recent and historic justice reinvestment legislation passed, 10 bills passed this last session, and what undergirded that historic legislation was a certain amount of truth-telling, a certain amount, Janae, of relationship building and healing, people really being able to deal with how they felt and the experiences that they've had. And finally, looking at how the law was actually aiding and abetting the roots of inequity. And that's something we see time and time again. And there's an enormous opportunity for Louisianans, and fortunately, the residents of Baton Rouge and New Orleans will be able to practice this, to really look at what legal policies are keeping us from being better, keeping us from being prosperous, and to make the progress that we want for our children and our communities at large.
Now, a core group of participants were individually selected to co-develop a local implementation plan. What does that plan look like, and are they different for both New Orleans and Baton Rouge?
You know, what's amazing about the process of so far, we have about 30 people, 15 in each community, who stepped forward to say, we're going to start this process. And they undertook an exercise when we were together with more than a dozen communities around the country in California looking at this work to say, what do we have in common? And what makes Baton Rouge and New Orleans unique?
Mm-hmm.
And so it won't surprise you that they were able to find some amazing commonalities with regard to opportunities to resolve inequities in the criminal justice system, in the access to jobs and entrepreneurism aspects, some of the legal constructs and other kind of housing and other things of that nature. Challenges that communities in New Orleans and Baton Rouge have in common, and also recognizing that Baton Rouge and New Orleans have unique cultures, have different backgrounds, a different way of being. And what's important in Louisiana and what we've learned at Foundations Louisiana is that in each community we work in, literally from parish to parish and across regions, we have to first listen to people on the ground to make sure we understand what it means to be successful in that place. And often it looks different from one place to the next. And so what you can expect, and we're hoping that people really step in and participate to make sure this is successful, is that people on the ground in each of the cities, Baton Rouge and New Orleans, will guide the way to make sure that we're doing the healing work, which then allows us to do the tough work of transformation.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we expect to see, the healing work and the transformation work that it's going to create the kind of change we want for our community.
And how does this healing work happen? Is it through a listening session or meeting? How does it happen?
You know, that's what's beautiful about the process. Each community gets to decide among a litany of options. We could have roundtable discussions and story circles. Folks can decide to create healing spaces for them inside of the work they do. So for people who are advocates or for people who are business people or for people who come from the faith community, what we expect is that people are going to make their own decisions about a permanent healing practice. Like many other programs, this is not a permanent program. So we have these resources from the Kellogg Foundation to help stoke a conversation and a set of practices that then local leaders will decide how we will permanently weave them into our way of being.
Mm-hmm.
What does it look like for our culture, our way of being, and how we practice our lives, both institutionally as well as personally and within our families? How do we build healing practices in, and how do we build transformation practices in that make us better and make us more whole?
So it's not permanent, but what's the long-term goal here?
You know, what I'm really grateful for is Kellogg is providing a challenge grant within these resources that will allow us to maintain permanent resources if we are successful in raising those monies that will allow us to develop permanent healing and transformation practices. So each city will decide what it looks like. We think that's going to be the best opportunity for us to create change and opportunity.
Flozell Daniels is the president and CEO of the Foundation for Louisiana. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
WWNO has received support from the Foundation for Louisiana. Every month, we talk to Richard Campanella about his Cityscapes column for NOLA.com and the Times-Picayune. This month, we learn about how population growth led to the expansion of New Orleans from the French Quarter into surrounding plantations. Here's WWNO's Jessica Rosegard.
The story starts basically talking about how plantations around the city of New Orleans were sold off after New Orleans' population outgrew the French Quarter, right?
That's right. French longlot plantations characterized most of the surveyed parcels outside of the French Quarter. And for the most part, these were enslaved plantations of indigo and rice, and then later on sugarcane. And so when the population of New Orleans started exploding right after the Louisiana Purchase, it started almost doubling every 15 years throughout the early 1800s, the natural adjacent space for New Orleans to grow into were these adjacent longlot plantations.
This outgrowth outside of New Orleans was called Lafayette, certainly not the Lafayette that we know that's a few hours west of here.
Yeah, I want to make that clear. The present-day city of Lafayette in south-central Louisiana was called Vermilionville at that time, and it wasn't until years later it was renamed Lafayette. So in the 1830s, if you mentioned Lafayette, just about everyone in Louisiana knew you meant that city immediately adjacent to New Orleans. So let me explain how this formed. Imagine the Lower Garden District. Imagine Felicity Street, okay? Jefferson Parish would have been upriver from that. And so those parcels there, one was from Felicity up to St. Andrew, was owned by the Ursuline nuns. It was an uncultivated parcel. And then the Panis family owned the next one, then the Livaday family, and then the Delisize family. From the 18-teens to the early 1830s, each of those families and the Ursuline nuns decided to hire a surveyor and lay down a street grid. So it's in that era that they transformed to a grid as opposed to agriculture. But then in 1825, the state designated that that area would be taken out of Orleans Parish and made into Jefferson Parish. And so the early residents of those three or four faubourgs had the question of governance on their mind. And so they determined that they could best control their political identity by incorporating as a city. And they chose the name Lafayette because that Panis plantation had been named Faubourg Lafayette. So in 1833, the city of Lafayette formed, and in the end, it would span from Felicity Street up to Toledano Street, and from the riverfront all the way to the back swamp.
How was life in Lafayette different from life in New Orleans?
Well, it would have been a peripheral community, essentially a suburb. And I should emphasize, in those days, if you were of means, if you had power, you wanted to live in the urban core. And the periphery was for more working class families. That's where the working class jobs were. These big nuisance emitting operations such as tanneries and, you know, boiling animal bones and tallow factories and canal excavation. That was on the urban periphery. And so lots of German and Irish immigrant families tended to settle this kind of low-density semi-rural periphery. And that's what the demographics that you would have seen in Lafayette, we call parts of it the Irish Channel to this day, along the riverfront, but it was just as German as it was Irish, and there were a multitude of other groups, also toward the back of town in what we now call Central City. But then something changed in the form of the what is now present-day St. Charles streetcar line going in, also in 1833. And so for the first time in New Orleans history, now it's a smooth and convenient ride to get from the urban core and to the periphery. And so what this enabled was for a much wealthier demographic to settle in the middle of Lafayette, not too close to the bustling riverfront by Chapultepec, nor from the environmental nuisances of the lower elevation back of town, but in that sweet spot in the middle, and thus the Garden District.
You mentioned in your article that that some aspects of life in Lafayette were better than in New Orleans.
Lafayette had things to boast about. It had ahead of its time public school system. It had newspapers. It had various businesses, police and fire protection. What it did not have was a nucleated town center. A downtown.
What are the remnants today of the former city of Lafayette?
Probably the most famous one is Lafayette Cemetery. That's why it's so called, okay? And there's also a couple of other cemeteries in the rear of old Lafayette in Central City that served that area. If you go along Magazine Street between Felicity and Toledano, note where the business clusters are and where the residential areas are. Every time you see a business cluster, that used to be a municipal market. That's where Lafayette residents would get their groceries. There's probably a few score, maybe more, of houses that date to the Lafayette era, which would be pre-1852. And then the street grid is almost identical to the decisions that were made by surveyors and planners back in the 18-teens and 1820s. There is also the building on Rousseau Street, just upriver from Jackson Avenue, which used to be the city hall, was later a police station, and now I think it's like a garage for Mardi Gras beads. but you could still see parts of that very unusual Egyptian facade.
Richard Campanella is a professor of geography at the Tulane School of Architecture. His Cityscapes column can be found every month on NOLA.com, the Times-Picayune.
The smell of political campaigns are in the air. New Orleans will hold primary elections for mayor and 7 city council seats on October 14th. Qualifying wrapped up last week with a last-minute rush of candidates. Joining me now to discuss the race and the names on the ballot is political analyst Dr. Silas Lee. Dr. Lee, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much.
So a few people announced months ago their bid for mayor. Those include Councilwoman LaToya Cantrell and former judges Desiree Charbonnet and Michael Bagnares. Who are the other candidates?
They remain the primary candidates at this point. So there were other candidates that they were talked about, such as Sidney Torres, as well as Walt Leger, and Karen Carter Peterson indicated that she was considering running, but those three decided ultimately not to run. So it comes down to LaToya Cantrell, Mike Bagnares, and Desiree Charbonnet. And we have other candidates who have qualified, but in terms of how competitive they will be, that remains to be seen, because these other candidates, they just qualified, but I think resources will be a major challenge for them given the amount of time they have.
Now, what are some of the issues most candidates are running on?
Well, all candidates seem to be running on, and they will discuss the dominant issue, that's public safety. Other issues you will probably hear about relate to the infrastructure, but public safety will be the dominant issue in this campaign.
What kind of race are we looking at here? Do you expect it to be one of those nasty races with a bunch of antagonizing political ads, or what?
Well, it's going to be very competitive. Now, the reality is that voters want to see the candidates compete. Now, in terms of when you say nasty, the candidates will defend themselves. They will respond to attacks. And if you don't respond, naturally, that leaves you vulnerable. So it will be a very competitive race. How competitive? We don't know yet.
With Mayor Landrieu being termed out, are you surprised at all by the number of candidates that the race has attracted?
Well, it's attracted fewer than expected, but I'm not that surprised given the challenges that we face in this community and the fact that some candidates, they were looking at it, but the political landscape and potential field of competitors probably was not that appealing to them, as well as the timing. So I'm not really that surprised.
What are voters looking for in candidates for this mayoral race?
Well, definitely voters are looking for a candidate to address the chronic issues of public safety plaguing this community. Naturally, the budget is an issue in terms of governing in this community. So they're looking for a candidate to address the chronic issues that voters are confronted with, as well as present and articulate how they will move this city forward.
Now, I know it's early to ask, but how likely is a runoff election for mayor?
Well, yeah, anytime you have three competitive candidates that what I call the top tier, then you have a second tier group of candidates, we have to wait and see. More than likely, yes, there will be a runoff. Who will be in that runoff? We don't know.
Political analyst Dr. Silas Lee, thanks for joining me today.
Okay, you're welcome.
And that's it for this week's edition of All Things New Orleans. I'm Janae Pierre. Follow me on Twitter at Miss Janae Pierre and feel free to tweet comments or questions. Would you like to suggest a guest or topic? Send an email to Janae at WWNO.org. That's J-A-N-A-E at WWNO.org. Visit our website to check out previous shows and be sure to catch us next week right here on 89.9 WWNO New Orleans and 90.5 KTLN Thibodaux Houma. Thanks for joining us. Underwriting programming on WWNO New Orleans Public Radio is a great way to support this station. And it's also a very effective way to reach informed, civic-minded, and educated adults in the New Orleans region with information about your business, service, or organization. Find out how WWNO 89.9 FM can help grow your business by emailing underwriting@wwno.org.